This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Neil Reynolds Podcast, episode 24. The eager-eyed among you will notice this is not Johnny Hecker, the punter of the Los Angeles Rams. Let's just say things are fluid in the NFL. So we've had to put off our interview with Johnny for another week. The Rams had their schedule for the players changed 15 times in one day on Thursday, which was when we were going to record with Johnny. So we will put that one on the back burner. But we're now going to talk to a fascinating character, a man who spent his entire life in football, Thomas Dimitroff. His dad, Tom Dimitroff, was a coach and a scout. Thomas has worked as an equipment manager, as a grounds crew, as a scout, as a general manager. He was most recently fired by the Atlanta Falcons earlier this season after 13 years in charge of that team. And coming from a football family, Thomas, it seemed, was always destined for a career in the NFL in one form or another.
This is one of those situations for me. I literally slid into this world, literally and figuratively speaking, into a football world. From the day I was born, I was around football. My dad was a football coach. Literally have been around football since the day I was born in those early years. And literally, I've always said I've done virtually every job in football along the way, whether it was, setting up the sideline headphones and managing through wires to picking up jock straps to the analytics side of it in the early days of analytics. To every element of working in the equipment room, the training room, in the coach's office. It's one of the things that I think had a big influence on how I approached my job as a general manager. As odd as that sounds, you take all of your history, of course, and that's what helps develop you in my mind as a leader. And I look back on all that, and many, many, many times being around a football field growing up had a lot to do with how I approach things now as an adult.
Yeah, I'm going to get into some of those because not every general manager in the NFL has washed the socks and painted the lines, but you did. And I wonder, when you were doing that equipment manager stuff, was it just for you? Did you just want to be around it at that stage? Or we all dream when we're younger. Did you have even then lofty ambitions as you're picking up jock straps and socks and things off the floor?
Well, I loved football from as long as I can remember. I idolized my dad, who was a longtime coach and scout in the NFL. Had been around it again all of my young years, and I was enamored with the sport, the competitive, the grittiness, the toughness. My interaction with players through the Canadian Football League when my dad coached there, and how many times I went in and asked for autographs, how often these players would ask me, like, wait a minute. Young Tom, they'd call me and they're like, you've already asked for this autograph 30 times. What are you selling them? And I would, like, it was just a big part of my world. And so all along, I wasn't thinking general manager. Back then I wasn't. Back to my being enamored with coaching and leadership. I wanted to be the best defensive coordinator. I've said this for as long as I can remember in the world. Like, that's what I wanted. I wanted to create the most ruckus, tough, hard-nosed defense, even in my younger years, because I was just really focused on a defense that I think could make a difference. Played defense growing up, albeit amateur, of course, but I loved the sport. I loved the training. I was talking, interestingly enough, with someone the other day, and we were discussing a Lance Armstrong podcast, and Lance was talking to Matthew McConaughey on his podcast, and he was talking about his idea of preparation being the most important to him and the most enjoyable. It's why he was obviously incredibly talented. Now, I know some of your people in the UK and around the world, not necessarily want to discuss that, but the reality is the result, the game might have been a 5 for him, and the enjoyment of preparation was a 10. I can attest to that. That is something that I've always enjoyed. I've always enjoyed being around my father's teams growing up, training with them, when I might have been 10, 15 years younger. Like, those were things that really got me stirred up, not only on the field, but when I was in the coaching room with he and his coaches, learning all the time. So That's what I really was keyed on in my early years. It's about coaching and wanting to be a coach in the NFL.
Was that the case even when you were a player? So you were a defensive back. Did you kind of know that this was just another, obviously you enjoy playing as a player and you enjoy the competitive nature of it, but did you expect that to be it and that it was just a part of your journey and maybe to be a coach as you thought?
No, it's interesting because I definitely was driven to be the best player I could be wherever that took me. I definitely had some overachiever to me. I always said I was quicker than fast, and that's my easy way of saying I wasn't. I was probably slower than I really wanted to be. But I worked on my technique day in and day out because I was a big believer in honing your skills is going to, make you the best player you can be, and work your craft was really important for me. All along in the back of my mind, yes, I was more thinking coaching long-term. Although my dad used to drill into my head in those early years in my early teens when I was a spindly little 120-pound guy, he would say, no, you're going to be 6 feet 205. And I was thinking safety at that time, right? So all of my life, I thought I was going to be a 6 feet 205 safety and having an opportunity to play pro football somewhere. And of course, that never happened.
I'd love to talk about your journey to the Cleveland Browns, but you went to the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. I was very interested to read you worked in the World League of American Football. They had the Team Dallas, of course, based there. I covered that league, but I was very, very young then, but I did start to cover that league. And then you coached a friend's team in Japan. When you went to Japan, did the NFL, it was literally miles away, but did it feel far away? Did you feel like what kind of route am I taking here to where I want to get to? What did you think about that whole period there?
Well, it was interesting because, yes, I had a friend who was the head coach over at Hitachi, and that corporate league is massive and it's very involved in its own way. And I thought it would be a great opportunity. It was when the World League was really going down because they were looking for funding. And we remember how that happened. I had a place in my life where I thought I could travel. At that point, quite honestly, I was at a real interesting crossroads. I thought either go to Japan and help my friend coach and be the defensive coordinator there, basically is what I was going to be, or do this whole Peace Corps thing. I mean, you want to talk about dichotomous personalities. I mean, I was just searching at that time, and I thought, what a better way I could travel but also be involved with football, something that I love and I'm passionate about. And I was over there, and I spent a good few months over there, and I really enjoyed it, and I learned the idea of, wow, this was a really, really clear idea to me about the unbelievably important side of communication and lucid communication, because if you're not clearly communicating when you have a language barrier, I mean, things will just completely break apart. And so it reminded me, honestly, in my days, even as a leader, coming back to all of our experiences along the way helped tee us up for what we're dealing with in our current situation. And I remember those days and I'm thinking, man, I'm going to have to really remember how important that is to be very clear, at times even remedial, and no insult to anyone. That's what people, they just want a clear understanding. And I think that can be the breakdown of a lot of really good coaches and teams if they're not clearly communicating. And I learned that in Japan. That was one thing I totally learned.
It's interesting. Wherever you've been, whether you're picking up socks, fixing headsets, working in Japan, it's important to you to kind of take bits as you go along the journey.
I've said that time and again. I mean, my time, wherever I have been, literally, all the way through those years when I was, a teenager and even younger, making mental notes, of course. I didn't start creating my proverbial GM interview book until a little later in my career, of course. But I was always kind of working on my proverbial book, and I learned a lot. Every stop that I have been in, I've learned a lot. And we can get into being around Scott Pioli and Bill Belichick at the Patriots and everything I learned there. And yes, we all have different personality traits, and you're going to jettison certain elements that may not be you personally, but you're going to take all of those really good, productive, informative, insightful ideas that would be incredibly beneficial. And I am a big believer in wherever I've been, I have taken parts all the way back to being raised by a football coach, hard-nosed, gritty football coach. Lately, and we haven't gotten into this, and this whole thing of recently being fired, you guys call it sacked there, don't you,
yep.
in the UK? I'm only light about it because – it's affected me, of course. I mean, 13 years in this role and 27 plus years in the NFL, this is the first time I've ever been terminated or fired in a job, and it's complicated in its own way. I have to keep it light as I can, because I know it will be short-lived. I know there'll be great things on the other side. But 13 years is a long time in this role here. And again, I've learned a lot, and I'm in this spot right now where I'm contemplating heavily, and I'm bringing this back around to a lot of the solitude that I'm having right now is allowing me to reflect on the historical part of my career. And wow, it's amazing when I really look at it, how many things I have picked up and how I've evolved as a person and as a leader since being involved in a really heavy leadership position in the National Football League.
So Thomas mentioned there his relationships with Bill Belichick and Scott Pioli. Belichick, we know, is one of the greatest NFL coaches of all time. And Pioli, his general manager, was, of course, a guest on this podcast earlier this year. While Scott worked with Thomas and ultimately ended up in the same place, their paths were very different. For Thomas, his dad was a coach. He worked as a scout, but like Scott Pioli, there was no silver spoon offered. Despite that NFL culture in his family, Thomas, like Scott and so many others, had to work to earn his NFL stripes.
Yeah, well, look, this came about. So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, the World League went down. I was living in Dallas at that time, went to Japan, came back from Japan after those months, was looking for a job, had potential opportunities in the business world. But I knew, this is an interesting thing, I knew that money was going to be exponentially better in the business world. And I didn't want to start making money and have to leave a job and go back into making a pittance in the NFL. People don't understand that. When you start at that low level in personnel departments and coaching departments, you're making virtually nothing, especially back then. I know that sounds like we used to walk through snow 10 feet tall, high, and et cetera, et cetera. But literally, where they are right now, comparatively speaking to where we were, was kind of interesting. So I go there. Initially, I tell my dad, I'm going to Amsterdam. I'm going to tour Europe. He was like all red faced, wondering, like, you cannot leave these opportunities. We have an opportunity for you to be involved and stay involved in the NFL, albeit on the grounds crew for now. You can do some scouting on the side, but we have this grounds crew job. You'll make money. This comes back to old school football coach guy with a toughness and a grittiness. And I'll be damned if you're going to go to Europe and hang around Amsterdam. And I thought, okay, I took a deep breath, and I joined the grounds crew with Cleveland Browns at that time. And that was how I interacted and started to develop a great bond and friendship with Scott Pioli, who at that time was, a low level scout. And we were both, knocking it around there, talking a lot about football, and he was involved on the pro personnel side a lot. And, many times I would be down on the field during the day in the morning, Scott will tell you the story, stinking like whatever. And I, was all painted up, trying to paint lines and doing everything else maintenance related. And I would come up at lunchtime and sit down, and, Scott and I would be talking about everything under the sun football. And I would be, lamenting on different things and talking about, wow, is this really where my life is going? This is what I'm going to be doing. I have an education. I love football. I have a pretty cool background, and I am painting fields and dropping seed all over this field. And so we developed a really good friendship. And I think at that point I realized more and more that not only during the day was I working on the grounds crew and trying to convince all the other grounds crew people that I had these aspirations to be a scout. And they would say to me, yeah, right, buddy. I'm sure you have a connection to get up there in the front office. They didn't know who I was. I kept it pretty quiet there because my dad was in the scouting department and I had connections up there. But in the evenings and during the weekends, I would go out and do some local scouting, and meaning some of the smaller schools around that Ohio, Pennsylvania area. And the most odd thing was during that time, I was literally doing some of that for the Kansas City Chiefs. Can you imagine?
Wow.
So Scott and Bill actually allowed me, of all people, we know about how strict Bill is, that Bill would let me do any sort of scouting for another team. And I think that was kind of a dirty little secret that was kept. Of course, it was at such a low level, and I wasn't necessarily going into the Kansas City Chiefs office, but I was scouting for them, and I was sending information back to the Chiefs, which I thought was fascinating after the fact, because as a GM now, and I am definitely on the left side of being anxious about things, a little more open-minded and liberal about it. I would never allow someone in our building who was scouting for even a minor league football team.
What do you think the key was to open that door, to get that time with Scott Pioli and to get that time with Bill Belichick? Because as you said, you're covered in fertilizer, you're covered in paint. Was it passion? Was it respect for the game? What do you think? What was it their desire? And I know Scott is very helpful, but people see Bill Belichick as a certain way. Was it a certain key that opened the door, or were they just really welcoming, do you think, and helpful?
No, I think it has those two, knowing Scott as well as I do and Bill, have a great deal of respect for people who are passionate about football. Yeah. You hit the nail on the head there. If I mean, the idea of me being out there working and also having my passion to double dip when I had to and maintain this job while I was looking for a job in the NFL in personnel and team building, I think that was something that struck them, and they'd shared that with me before, and I appreciate it, humbly speaking. I know that for sure my relationship with Scott was built on that, because we both had this really deep passion and knew that we weren't worried about the money at that time. We weren't worried about the status. We were just worried about being involved with a sport that we love from the bottom of our souls. And I don't mean to be melodramatic about that, but that was what I was during that time. That's why when people meet me now and, you know, they see me as sort of 165 pound, you know, avid cyclist, they're like, this guy wasn't a football guy. I mean, I live and breathed all my life. That was my passion. And I love it today, of course. And so it's a little complicated, but during those times, I think that, yes, was a very important part of my relationship, Bill, with both Scott and Bill.
Just very quickly, because I want to get into the general manager stuff. What was it like life on the road as an area scout? Is it literally have suitcase, will travel?
Yes, no question about it. I mean, those were funny years for me. I started off in the Southeast, living here in Atlanta, where I am now. That many years ago, I was scouting the Southeast for Blesto, which was a scouting group of teams, and we can get in that another time. I was working for the Detroit Lions and Blesto during that time when I started in the NFL. That was where I really hit the road, and I was on the road a lot. I was performing pro days for not only the Lions but this Blesto scouting group, and that was complicated. Getting, you know, you're around every day. You're moving around. Very tough to start relationships with girls during that time. You know, you just start a relationship and 2 weeks later you break up because they just never see you anymore. So it had its lonely times, but in the end, the passion for the game and the passion for evaluating, I realized more and more as I started going through the whole evaluation side of it all, I realized my passion for looking at talent and evaluating movement. I'm a big believer where my evaluation always starts is movement and body control and athleticism, because I think, you know, this is a matchup game and a matchup league. And if you can't move adeptly and you're not able to match at whatever position you're playing, you have no chance of succeeding. So I had a real interest in that in my early years of scouting. And that's when I started realizing, man, maybe I'm going to be focused on this versus going into coaching. In the background, in the back of my mind and in the background of my world, I always thought, but maybe I'm going to get into coaching again after doing a little bit with Team Dallas. And then I decided as I started getting into this, how much I really loved the evaluation side. I was all over the place because I eventually moved out west and was working out west, living in Boulder, Colorado, which I loved because I'm a big outdoors person. And I would start my trip in Denver, Boulder, and drive all the way up through the Northwest. And I was in a Eurovan, so a Volkswagen Eurovan. You guys are good out there in Europe with these camper vans. And I would have all of my stuff with me. At that time, I was a very stout and staunch, vegetarian. So I had all of my cooking utensils and all of my rice and all. I was trying to live the cleanest life I could. You can imagine traveling around all these states. All these old school scouts would be bemoaning me, saying, hey, don't you dare let our bosses know that you're spending $32 staying at a KOA or a campsite. So we had some fun times with that. Luckily, my dad was the one that knew everyone in that business as well. So it helped me. They might have thought I was a little bit different than a lot of the other guys traveling around in that world, but because my dad was who he was, tough, hard-nosed football man, it broke some ice for me. And I had some great relationships during those times. But I literally was on the road for months and months at a time, which became complicated. And I will say, at one time, I put a video cam on my dashboard and literally drove for 2 months with it on. It would be amazing to see that. I have not found it. I'm trying to find the video somewhere, because it was in those early years of my scouting life where I'm thinking, wow, there was some pretty good footage there, I'm sure, to document my world.
From being a scout, Thomas would eventually get his opportunity to be in the big chair running a football team as a general manager. That move came in 2008 when he joined the Atlanta Falcons. And Thomas enjoyed early success, twice being named as an NFL Executive of the Year. That success, however, and the pressure that went with that role would have been very different to his life on the road as an NFL scout.
Well, I think we should go back to the interview very quick, because you know, I was in Boulder, Colorado at that time. I was working for Scott and Bill and the Patriots, and I was living in Boulder, but back and forth to Boston all the time, which was a long travel and a lot of travel. But I love Colorado. I was the director of college scouting at that time. So I was traveling all over the country anyway. So I had a good home base in an area that I loved. It was my utopia, being out in the mountains and being able to do my thing and also be involved with football. I mean, I was in a really good spot that way. And, you know, during that time, I would, again, be traveling all over the place. And when I had an opportunity to interview, when Arthur Blank and the Atlanta Falcons were looking for a replacement for Rich McKay during that time, it was all during the Michael Vick debacle. I remember getting an opportunity to interview, and I thought, I am in such a good place in New England for a lot of reasons, not only being compensated better than I thought I would have been ever probably in this sport at that point, and then also having a job that I really enjoy, being a director of college scouting, because my focus was on draft and college work, that when I got there and interviewed with Arthur, I was literally 13th probably in 13th in line. People often say to me, Thomas, didn't that bother you? Wasn't that offensive that you were so far down the line? Because, you know, Arthur had all these big-time GMs, head coaches like Pete Carroll and Bill Cowher and Bill Parcells that he was really interested in. And if you know Arthur, you know, Arthur's got a real interest in, you know, established individuals. Those guys didn't come on board. There was a whole next group, Neil, of guys who were former general managers who were interviewing. And then there was me and a few other riffraffs. And I remember something that I'm incredibly proud of when I speak in public, you know, speaking engagements or talk to kids or mentoring. I am so proud of the fact, and I say it humbly, but very proud of the fact that I was way down the list. I wasn't offended. I took a big swing. I'm using a baseball analogy, but took a big swing for the fence, and felt really comfortable with where I was. And in the end, a week later, Arthur hires me after this really lengthy interview. And we just hit it off very, very well on a lot of levels. It was not just for me when I interviewed, interestingly enough, just about the building of the football team and the idea of scouting. To me, that already got me there. And I already, again, humbly had a reputation for being adept at what I was doing and a hard worker in that area. I'm a big believer in those situations for any of your listeners and any of us. You have to differentiate yourself, because there, again, 13 plus different people interviewing for that job. How was I going to differentiate myself from the rest of the group? And the way that I did that was I took a real interest in the building of the team and athletic performance as it pertained to football, as it pertained to what's the front end of the curve? How are we going to make our players the best that they can totally be on the field, so that we can maximize their abilities, maximize their length in the league, you know, so that they can maximize their earnings. So, you know, your best players need to stay on the field. Athletic performance had a lot to do with that. So that was one of my sell points when I was interviewing, back to differentiating myself. And, you know, thank God it all worked out. And that was the start to how I approached my general manager job, which was always striving to be on the front end of the curve. Luckily, I had an owner who was open to me being on the front end of the curve and didn't dissuade me from spending money where it need be.
We'll be back with more on the Neil Reynolds podcast after this short break.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds podcast.
Welcome back to my conversation with former Atlanta Falcons general manager Thomas Dimitroff. Now, before the break, Thomas explained to me his approach to being a GM. A quote he's become known for during his time was, "Go big or go home." And he lived by that mantra. The Falcons were often aggressive in drafts that Thomas was involved in. They were trading up in order to put a competitive team on the field. And that happened with Julio Jones, the star wide receiver in 2011. It was a big move for the Falcons and for Thomas. It was an approach to the draft that became very much about players over plays. Getting players on the roster who would win their matchups regardless of the playbooks.
There's no question about that, Neil. What happened with me is, in those first, you know, I got there in 8, so 8, 9, and 10, before we drafted Julio in 11, I continue to go into games thinking, we need a difference maker. We need a difference maker that's going to have teams and defenses on their heels all the time. Whether that player catches 4 balls or 14 balls in a game, make sure that the teams that we're playing are worried about playing the Atlanta Falcons offense with Matt Ryan and a guy like Julio, in the end, a guy like Julio Jones. And I looked around different teams and I had seen different people, and I'm like, you know, watching players out there who had defenses on their heels. And I thought, that's exactly what we need. So it precipitated a move like that. And I was realizing in those first early years of my GM world that I wasn't flippant about things, but I definitely realized really early on when I was finally in that seat and in charge that I was an aggressive type of person when it came to acquiring. I realized very early on the not for long idea of the NFL. You've heard that joke, right? Yep. NFL stands for not for long. And I realized very early, if you're going to sit on your hands and you're going to hesitate with decision making, you'll never last in this league. Now, I took some pretty aggressive approaches to Julio and other moves, no question about it. And if I look back on that, if Julio would have fallen by the wayside, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now, and I would not have been in the league for 13 years in that capacity. But I do totally believe in the idea. When I say go big, go home, yes, I'm stealing that from the X game sect for sure, yep. But I do believe in it. I mean, you have to go for it, and that's what I believe. I believe it instills a lot of passion in the group around you. Again, never flippantly. I'm a big believer in being well thought out. Scott is a very well thought out guy. Scott Pioli, of course, I learned that side from him and Bill. I always keep that in mind. And I also believe you can be very thought out and very methodical in your own way, but also be very aggressive. And I love how those two, although it may seem contradictory at times, how they work together with my personality.
Yeah, Thomas, you'll enjoy this. When we had the Falcons over for the London game, so I did a one-on-one with Julio in the week leading up to the game on Sky Sports. So we tried to work out how high Matt Ryan could throw the ball and Julio could get it. So we kind of worked out Julio's vertical leap at the combine, his height and his wingspan. And we put this ball up on the top of a pole, and it must have been the top of a basketball backboard, maybe more. And I stood there with Julio and he looked up at it and he went, "I can go higher than that." I was like, "Wow, what?" And it's only actually when you put it into that, because as mere mortals, let's say we're just mere mortals, it's only when you actually say, "Well, actually, you could throw it all the way up into the sky, and Julio Jones is going to come down with it." Because everyone jumps, everyone looks. It's all relative, right? Because if you've got a defensive back who can jump 38 inches, it doesn't look like Julio's jumping that high. But when you actually put it into perspective, wow, what an athlete!
Well, what an athlete. And the perspective, you're exactly right. The more I watch Julio Jones, back to that very quickly, you know, thinking about that and bringing a person like that into an organization who is a difference maker, and he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, I think, and I say that respectfully to the process. Normally Hall of Famers don't like you to say that. I'm not saying it lightly. He's one of the best to ever play that position. And it's been fun watching him over the years.
Obviously there are difficult side to your job. Mike Smith gets let go as head coach, and you move on to Dan Quinn. Every year you have to let players go. Tell me about that for you, how you've dealt with that, and did it kind of have an impact on you each year, or do you have to kind of harden yourself to it?
You know, it started way back in those early years with Mike Smith. We decided that we were going to release all players, every player in the organization, we were going to release together. Carried over into Dan Quinn, you know, over the last 6 years, was something that both coaches who I have great relationships with before and after our firings, we all agreed that we would come together as a team. The head coach would ultimately deliver the message in that living room space or around the conference table when we were delivering the message. And I would comment on it as well. But by both of us being there as a team, it felt like a familial deal where we were delivering together. There were no mixed messages. We knew that. And that was one of the things I did learn from Scott and Bill as well. You know, you have one person delivering a message and that player comes back down to my office after he's dealt with a head coach hypothetically. That can get dusty, right? And it can get cumbersome. We figured we would both be there. And we literally, I would say, I mean, the majority of people that we ever released, we released together since I've been there for 13 years with the head coach. Never did we say for spells, you do this or I'll do that. We didn't pawn it off ever to personnel directors. We thought it was a responsibility of the two guys at the top of the team building situation in the football ops to take care of it. And it was tough. I will say this. Yes, it was complicated and difficult. I will say, however, that there are certain releases that aren't as difficult. When someone's made $50, $75, or $100 million, you're like, hey, man, I know that's tough. You're not feeling that bad for them. You're feeling bad for the person who comes in who has a situation at home, who's really talented, who has their life in front of them, and then all of a sudden they battled with injuries and their life has just taken a downslide. Those are the guys you really hurt heart-wise, and we've had some of those over the years for sure.
Now, for a man with Thomas's experience, watching the Falcons surrender a 28-3 lead against the New England Patriots in Super Bowl 51 must have been a torturous experience. He wasn't just a GM, but a GM who had played, had coaching in his blood, and had scouted during his football career. As the general manager, he was responsible for getting that Falcons team on the field, but unable to call the plays and influence the actual game, he must have felt helpless as the Patriots clawed their way back to victory.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of those things to take you back, you know, through the game, the beginning of the game, the first two quarters and at halftime. I am rarely, you know, in front of my skis. That's not me, right? I'm a realist and I understand things can change quickly. But that was the first game where I thought, you know, we have a really good chance of winning this game against, you know, one of my mentors. And you know, all due respect to Bill, I mean, you always want to beat the person that you've learned so much. You know, you want the there's something competitive about that, and it's a massively important thing. So yes, I was feeling like I didn't need to be in control at that time, you know, right? Like I was thinking they're taking care of business. My feet are up on the proverbial table right now because there's nothing I can do. It's often said in our league for general managers, one of the most difficult things, you could talk to Ernie Accorsi, you know, formerly of the Giants and of the Browns, and you know, a famous general manager, game day, you have nothing, you can't call down. You actually get fined and lose draft picks right if you call down to the sideline. And, you know, you can't order a blitz or a screen or damn it, go deep to Julio Jones five times in a row. I wish I could do that. You can't. So that is a helpless feeling when you are sitting there when things start going awry. And as that game started progressing and you got into the middle of the fourth quarter, unbelievable waves of emotion, as you can imagine. And this churning in your stomach about, you got to be kidding me. And you have to remember, and Scott and I were in that situation, I'm looking at this knowing how many times over, and I was only there 6 years in New England, how many times the greatest of all time, because I think Tom is the greatest quarterback ever, that when that guy gets hot, there's never any stopping him. So we get to that point, and all of a sudden we're flipping in you know, for an overtime, and he gets the flip. I mean, obviously I've never said that, you know, publicly, but I know what that guy does when he gets the flip and he's got the pressure on him. And that was a tough situation. And, you know, there it was. It came to fruition. He marched down the field the way he did. And it was unbelievable.
When that confetti's falling, was there any, did you just feel like you've been kicked in the gut, or was there any thought already to, okay, now we have a process we need to work through in the off season. There are going to be some scars. We need to, did you even think about how you were going to navigate through that at that time, or was it just pure emotion?
Oh, it was emotion, but it was kicked in the shins, knees, gut, face. I mean, it was, yeah. It just never stopped. And I remember thinking how difficult it was and how long of a journey it was through a season to get there, from literally going all the way back to prep in the spring to training camp, That is a long, long process. That's why if you really look into that, a little aside here, you think about everything that New England's done over the years and those teams that have multiple Super Bowls, that is unbelievably difficult and enervating at times. As great as it is, you can imagine, you're putting your heart and soul into that as a team and navigating through that. So it was tough. And I started thinking the accolades that you get and the lauding that you get for being a Super Bowl winning head coach, player, general manager is very different than being an NFC winning head coach, GM, player. Still accomplished, and I appreciate it, but it's one of those tough things. I had an opportunity to be a part of Super Bowls as a mid-management guy, you know, in New England, but you know, we all want to be in that spot where you're at the helm to be able to say you did it, and unfortunately you came up short. And it's one of those things that I look back on. I don't dwell on it. It's a learning experience for me. I share it with my son who's 13, Mason, and my daughter who's 7. She doesn't get it that much. I share it with a lot of the people in our business. Like, we can't do anything about it. You need to learn from it. And what did we learn from it? There are so many lessons to be learned from losing a big and historical game like that. Mm.
Last couple, just obviously on you know, how things went this season and what the future holds for you. Obviously, things hadn't started well for the Falcons. Sometimes it's the coach. It's not always, or actually quite rarely, is it the coach and the general manager at the same time. Were you surprised? How did that all come about for you? And you don't have to go into all details. You just tell me which bits of it you want to tell me, of course. But obviously, that would be like a kick in the stomach, I'm sure, after 13 years.
It is. I have no problem talking about it. I made an effort coming out of this this recent firing where I was saying, you know, I'm going to do something maybe a little different than most general managers. I feel like a lot of people kind of drift away and they go into a sort of solitude, and that's important. I get it. And everyone's different, but I really wanted to talk about it a little bit more because a lot of people don't share that and share the emotions, trying to take care of it and talk about it gracefully enough and tactfully enough. Have I had my ups and downs? The way I describe it, first of all, yes, I was surprised. Not unprecedented. I mean, it has happened to a good friend of mine, Jerry Reese from the Giants. I mean, won 2 Super Bowls, and after 8 games, he was, again, to use your terminology, he was sacked. A really good general manager. But there haven't been that many. Normally, a general manager lasts until the end of the season if in fact, a move is going to be made with the coach. And let me add, I think Dan Quinn is a hell of a football coach, a really good motivator, and I think his future is still bright. It was time at that point. Arthur brought us in, Arthur Blank, our owner, and in the end, you know, his ultimate loyalty is not necessarily to Dan and me, appropriately. His ultimate loyalty is to the fan base. And he felt he needed to win the fan base back, and that was his way of doing it. And I'm sure when he looked at it all, he had to make a decision of, do I need a complete regime change, new eyes, new opinions? And again, I thought that it was going to be at the end of the season when we would reevaluate. Quite honestly, right now, that team is one brain freeze away with the Todd Gurley touchdown from being 4-0 since the sackings. And that's I watch it closely, interestingly enough, Neil, and I want them to win every game because I think it's a good football team. For some reason, and I will tell you this, I've used the analogy, that sort of symphonic analogy. There's a lot of, I think, really good football players / musicians in that symphony. But from one day to the next, one game to the next, one group is playing well, another subpar, another really well, another okay. It's so important for everyone to come together and be in sync. And for some reason, over the last couple of years, that has not happened.
So Thomas Dimitroff was dismissed as the Falcons general manager early in the 2020 NFL season. But rather dwelling on the recent past or present, he's a man focused on the road ahead and his next challenge. He's an avid cyclist, for instance. Indeed, during our chat, you could see his road bike in the corner of the room, and there was a painting of another bike over his shoulder. So could we see him appear in another sport, or is he eager to get back into the challenges of running a major NFL franchise?
It's a great point. You know, I was told by a number of very sagacious people out there, one being Arthur Blank, hey, don't rush into anything, and I have a great deal of respect for Arthur. you know, as an owner who I was with for 13 years, an incredible businessman. I do understand that. I don't want to rush into anything. That being said, I do want another opportunity to build a championship caliber football team and next time win a Super Bowl. That for sure is hanging in my world. Opportunities. That said, it has to be the right situation. It has to be, everything has to be, you know, set up in the right way. I'm after 13 years in this league and in this league as a GM and 27 plus, I'm going to be choosy about where I go. You can imagine, Neil, if it's back in the NFL, you know, I've thought about some media opportunities. Of course, this is the next pocket, which could be good for a number of reasons, relevancy, but just being able to talk about draft and free agency, that's of interest to me. And then there's this whole other pocket, this area of the business of sport and opportunities and things. I am involved with right now with a group called Super Sapiens, and Super Sapiens is an incredible group of people right now. It's a continuous glucose monitoring technology. I'm really interested. I alluded to it earlier about being on the front end of the curve, and emerging technologies in our league is going to be massively important, whether it's the analytics of the league or whether it's performance element ideas of continuous glucose monitoring to be able to monitor and stabilize your blood sugar to see where your performance is going to be optimal, not only for your physicality on the football field, but your brain functioning and making decisions is one of the things I want to talk to Dan Quinn about, or some coaches in the league. Instead of drinking Red Bull all night to try to stay up, the idea of being able to monitor where your blood levels are, your glucose levels are, is fascinating to me. This group in Super Sapiens that I'm dealing with, again, they are kicking off in Europe. I think you guys keep an eye on it. It's a really interesting deal. There are a number of us on the board. So on the advisory board is myself, R.C. Buford with the San Antonio Spurs, and Brian Cashman with the New York Yankees. These are all guys who have won a lot more championships than I have ever won. David Brailsford, one of the most important for your European side, is very involved with this. And we hang on his words. Sir David, the way that he approaches things, we really enjoy that because we love it outside of our own sports. And he's on that board along with Chip Hawkins from Wahoo, the cycling computers group. So there's about eight of us right now who are really involved in this group who think that this could be the next wave. It's not only it's glucose monitoring right now, but other analytes are going to be added to this in time, i.e. lactate and potentially ketones. That's a holy grail eventually. So being on the front end of that is going to be really important. And I'm loving being involved in that while I'm in the interim.
I knew I'd end up with follow-up questions because there's two little carrots you dangled for me there. I've got to ask you now. So work-life balance, how important is that to you? You mentioned you cycle, you like to get out into the mountains. And actually, you've talked there about Dan Quinn, you know, coaches burn the midnight oil. I've been around the NFL, around training camps, and Sean Payton's shown me, oh, these are the bunks where our guys sleep in the office. And this is, and not many people balance that well. Was work-life balance important to you when you were general manager of the Falcons?
It has always been a part of what I am, coming through any part, any levels. And when I got to the general manager job, it was a massive focus for me. Even when I interviewed with Mr. Blank in that early interview back in 2008, I stressed the importance of making sure that this was a journey, and this is not hokey, but I believe it at the core of my soul. You better enjoy the journey or you will never be as productive. You will never be as insightful or mentally acute if you're not enjoying the journey to some level. The idea of it being drudgery and you have to work until, you know, one in the morning and beat yourself up every day of the week. We know that that's ridiculous. It's not productive. It is, God bless them, it's a thing of the past. There is a way in my mind to make sure that you are balancing, whether it's the mind, body, and soul element, which I'm a big believer in. I think that's very, very important. Eating well, of course, fitness during the time, making sure that you are having your time and getting fresh air. Again, I'm an avid cyclist. I love snowboarding when I get out to Colorado. I love hiking. I understand how important it is. I lost my father, unfortunately, when he was 60 years old, to renal cell carcinoma, which is kidney cancer. That's not the driving force behind me, but it is a realization that life is fleeting. Even if you're living to be 90, 100, or 110, which is going to be interesting how this these next generations are able to navigate. It is a blip on the screen, and so balance is important. I do not want to look back, and I am paraphrasing. I use this recently in a podcast with Greg McKeown, who wrote the book Essentialism. The idea of when I come to die, find out that I have not yet lived is a really, really important part of my world. That's a Thoreau quote again, paraphrasing. That idea of sitting back and saying, I just sat in the office every day of my life looking at video, that's not appealing to me. I want to interact with all the people. I want this job as a general manager to be multiple layers. It's not just sitting in there watching players. It's about interacting. It's about leading. It's about mentoring. I realize that as I get into my 50s, the importance of that tug on my world to make sure that I am sharing. One of my own family mantras that I instilled with my family since I've had my kids probably over the last, since I've had this job is soar, savor, and share. Soaring meaning back to not sitting on your hands, going big or going home, going, you know, shooting for the stars. The savor side of it is while you're doing all that, savoring where you are in this life, savoring your journey, whether it's low level in the, you know, doing anything, painting fields, or whether it's middle management stuff where you're all over the place traveling like a madman, or whether you're sitting at the helm of an organization, that's really important to savor where we are and savor the journey elements. And then the share side is giving back, not only philanthropically, money-wise, but giving back your knowledge and your intelligence. Being able to paint/write your masterpiece and share that to me is vital. And I can't wait to continue to do that, God willing, for many years to come.
Yep. Last one then. My ears pricked up, the journalist radar, when you said, when I get back into the NFL, I want it to be the right situation. What is the right situation? Is it having a franchise quarterback? Is it culture? Is it a team with a bag full of draft picks? Or is it none of those things or a combination of? What is it?
Well, I know. I think it's opportunities to make sure that there are the draft picks, that you have a solid foundation of players. But understand that my art and my background, and I'm sure Scott Pioli would say this about himself, we grew up as evaluators and someone we take a lot of pride in. So I want to come into an organization where I'm able to use my skills. Yes, I've learned about salary cap and I've learned about, you know, player programs and development and athletic performance. But at the core, at the very core, what I am and what I pride myself on is looking at a player and evaluating those players. And that's something that I do take a lot of pride in. And that's what I want to do when I go into an organization. So I think that's going to be really important. So whether there's a quarterback or not a quarterback, there's an opportunity to get a quarterback is going to be vital. I think it's going to be a situation where the ownership group understands that you are there to be the expert in your job and to allow you to be who you are and you know, be the co-team builder of a football team and have the right hierarchy set up where there are limited impediments, because you can go into certain organizations, they may have a lot of positives, but if the hierarchy is not set up in the way that I might think is, you know, beneficial to making sure that you're getting your points across and you're leading properly, well, then it can become complicated. Without mentioning names, there are teams in the NFL who are really good football teams, but are complicated and cumbersome. And I think there needs to be a clarity in delivering to an owner and an ownership group of how important it is. Pay those coaches and those general managers to do their job. If they're not doing their job, I am all about they need to be fired. I get that. Important to make sure in these organizations that new or head coaches go into or GMs that the hierarchy is set up properly, and that is something that I think is important for me.
Okay, there is my conversation with Thomas Dimitroff, former general manager of the Atlanta Falcons. Time to hear from you now as we go into the mailbag. Let's bring in producer Gary Hayes. Gary, I think we both enjoyed chatting to Thomas earlier this week.
It was a very intellectual conversation.
Very good, yeah.
A meaty one as well. It was a long episode.
It was. He was very honest about a lot of stuff. A lot more forthright than I thought he would have been, but that was great. And he's a really good guy, always willing to help others. I can't wait to see where he lands next. What you got for us in the mailbag?
Well, because of the length of the episode, I thought I'd just give you one question this week because... yeah, I don't want to keep everyone on the line too long. So, but it is an interesting question because it's something that I want to ask you as well about the podcast, because sometimes we've run it fine. So, and I guess given the fact that the Hecker interview didn't happen, it's from Elliot Lee on Twitter, and he asks, what is the closest you've ever been to missing a show?
This is it was one that drove me mad and crazy. I've just referenced this for our American listeners. I drive about 90 minutes into the Sky Sports studios to host shows, NFL shows. I go around the freeway that goes around London. It's called the M25. Everyone who's listening from the UK knows the M25. So it's the end of the 2008 season, Gary, and I'm not even a regular on Sky. I'm just doing a few kind of Monday night overnights, 3 o'clock in the morning, that sort of thing, just filling in when no one else wants to do them. And then I get a call from my producer saying, oh, we want you to be a part of the Super Bowl studio. So we've got a studio in London, we've got a studio in America, we want you to be a part of it. And I was just made up, because I've been watching Super Bowl since I was a kid, and it was the first one I was going to be involved with. And to me, it was a massive, massive deal. It was a big moment in my kind of life covering the NFL. So we're going on air at 10 o'clock UK time. Call time, I've got to be at Sky at 8 o'clock. So I leave home at 6 o'clock to a light flurry of snow, a little bit of dusting of snow coming down.
I know where this is going.
You know where it's going, right? I get onto the M25. It just opens up. It's like a blizzard. You can't see 5 foot in front of you. It was terrible. The M25 became a car park. Nothing's moving. The long and short of it was, and I'm just getting more and more stressed. I'm like almost like shaking. I can't believe it. My first Super Bowl. I'm actually going to miss going on air. How can you do that? And I'm ringing my producer, and we're getting later and later, and 8 o'clock passes. 9 o'clock passes. Okay, we're into the last hour. We've got an hour to go before we're going live. Just to cut the rest of what's a long story short, I pull up at Sky at 3 minutes to 10. We go on air at 10. We pull up at 3 minutes to 10, screech to a halt. And one of the runners has to come out and park my car while a producer grabs it. It's still blizzarding. It's snowing all the way down. A producer has to come and get me. Run me into the studio. I'm sitting down as they go live, and then there's like all the credits and a bit of a feature at the start. I get into the chair at about 1 minute past 10. We've gone on air at 10. They make me up while I'm sat in the chair, and then they come into the studio, and there I am, and away we go.
I was going to ask about the makeup. How did you get the makeup on?
But they just slapped it on. I think it was just throw it and hope for the best. I'm sweating. I'm in a right old state. And basically, we did the show. It was a great show. Big Ben throws the winning touchdown to Santonio Holmes in the corner of the end zone. Then I leave. All of us production guys and the talent, we're having a snowball fight in the car park as we're walking back to our cars. And it took me 4.5 hours to drive home. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning when I got home, broad daylight. Wow. Had some breakfast, then went to bed.
But it must have been worth it. It must have been worth it.
It was. But it was the most stressful. The most stressful night I think I've had covering the NFL. I went to bed for about 4 hours, slept for a bit, was too wired, woke up, built some snowmen in the back garden with the kids because they were off school.
So how close have you ever come to missing a podcast?
Well, they're not live, are they? So never.
What do you mean this isn't live? You're killing the illusion.
Well, me and you, we cut it fine quite a few times. Yeah. So, but that doesn't bother me because I'll just record it another time. This one, back in the end of the 2008 season, yeah, I was a bit of a mess. So, but I made it. I made it. That's the main thing.
I didn't want to drag the mailbag out, but I have got a question for you, actually, that I was thinking of as you were telling that story. Have you ever considered a career, or did you consider a career as a weatherman? Because all these stories you always come out with where you're like, oh, what's your worst experience in America? Oh, it was raining. Oh, there was thunder. Oh, and then I had to go pit side in the balmy 55-degree Fahrenheit weather, and it snowed. Everything is about the weather.
I love the weather. I love weather, and the only thing better than bad weather, or weather that is kind of out of the norm, is weather that's out of the norm combined with the NFL. So like a couple of weeks ago, I was really excited when the Cleveland Browns game got delayed because of lightning. I love I love snow games. They're the best. You know, who can't beat a snow game? So yeah, I am weirdly obsessed with weather. When I went to Kansas City Chiefs training camp, what year was that? Probably 2015. I loved it because you just put on normal TV in Kansas City. If you put on the normal TV, they have a constant corner box that has a radar showing where the tornadoes are coming in. Brilliant. Loved it. Edge of the seat stuff. It was fantastic. So yeah, you rumbled me.
You must have loved the Patriots against the Ravens then in the rain.
Yeah, I love it all. I love all of those sorts of games. As long as I, and I even went to a preseason game in Tampa with the family, Bucks against the Browns in Tampa. If you watch Hard Knocks that year, there's an episode where they play the Browns and they start talking about Chris Godwin, the wide receiver for the Bucks. In the background is an empty stadium with five fools sitting under ponchos. That's me and the family. They thought they were just going for Disney World, but they got all of that as well. So, but yeah, that's me. I love a bit of weather. So.
Well, I'll leave you to your barometer and your weather channel.
We are done for this week, and we are going to, like, now Gary, in 2020, the NFL is a kind of day to day, week to week proposition. I've been told many times by league officials it's fluid. So I'm not going to promise Johnny Hecker next week. Let's just say it's fluid, but there will be an episode of the Neil Reynolds podcast, and you'll have to tune in to find out who it is. So my thanks to producer Gary Hayes, to Thomas Dimitrov, who was excellent, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. Spread the word, give us a review on iTunes, leave us a rating. It all helps, and we'll see you next week. Bye for now. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.